Konnichiwa. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'm honored that you're here. Thank you for giving me a good reason to come and visit Japan again. I had a great time visiting some customers yesterday who were starting to bring DevOps to Japan. This talk is about our experiences inside Microsoft, specifically in the group I work with in developer division, Visual Studio Team Services, in our journey toward DevOps. If you were here for the panel discussion a few minutes ago, you already heard me talk about who I am. I've been at Microsoft for 13 years. I've been working in this area of helping bring tools for developers. You may have encountered some of my books. Some have been translated into Japanese, or the paper about this journey, which I think is in English only. Anyhow, it's about what we have done internally. It's not really a product story about or a product demo, it's about what we've learned. So the story begins around 2010, 6 years ago. We had Visual Studio, at that time, Visual Studio Team System, which included Team Foundation Server, the on-premise server. We'd gotten great recognition from the analysts. We had great customer response. We were recognized as industry leader. And we said, well, you know, we have this on-premise product that's doing very well in the market, but we know we need to also start thinking about software as a service. So we started at that time investing in bringing what was Team Foundation Server, TFS, to the Azure cloud. We could in a few months host TFS on a cloud instance, but it took us a few years before we really could get to a multi-tenant cloud service. Now, we started doing that in preview mode. We got many users. By 2013, that is after 3 years, we thought we were in a great state. We were ready to announce general availability. It was November in New York. We had a big conference like this. And that morning, we opened up all of the exposure control and let everyone join as we announced general availability. We went way over 1 million users in one data center, and we had an 8-hour outage. No one could get in. Don't do that. Don't do it that way. We discovered that we had network address table exhaustion. We had more problems after that and more problems after that. So it was a great example of not doing gradual exposure, not doing things in stages, but doing things all at once. From that, we've had some years to learn, and we've learned what we now call the 7 habits of good DevOps. So these are the things we have learned becoming a software as a service provider. First, there's team autonomy and enterprise alignment. Second, managing technical debt. Third, focusing on the flow of value to the customer. Fourth, using a backlog that's groomed with learning. Fifth, using evidence gathered from production. Sixth, applying a production-first mindset. And seventh, managing infrastructure as a flexible resource. I'm going to go through these in turn and give you very concrete examples of what we mean. First, team autonomy and enterprise alignment. Sorry? What do we mean by a team? This is a picture of a team in the building where I work. This is a team room. A team is a scrum team. We call them a feature crew. I think 8 to 12 people. Amazon calls these two pizza teams because you can feed the team with two pizzas. If you can't, you have too many people. When they want to have their daily stand-up, because they're all in one room, they just stand up and they walk over to one area and they talk. If they want to talk during the day, they just turn to each other and talk because they're all working on the same thing. This isn't a little piece of a big open space like this. This isn't one table out of many, many, many tables. This is a self-contained room, and you go around the corner and there's another self-contained room. Everyone in this room is working on the same feature area. They're pulling items from the backlog that are related together. And then there are little rooms to the side called focus rooms where four people or five people can go to have a meeting. You don't reserve them. And there are whiteboards everywhere. How do we plan? Well, on the one end, the team is responsible for working in sprints. Our sprints are 3 weeks. We've gotten to this empirically. It works for us to do three sprints. We work in Redmond on the West Coast, in Raleigh on the East Coast, in Hyderabad, India. Those are our major centers. We also have people in Israel and people in Europe, and we now have a center in China, so we're very distributed. We're now in sprint 101, so we've been at this for a while, 6 years, with everyone synchronized on the same sprints. If you want to work well, just put everyone on the same sprints. That's one end of the calendar. The other end, important thing, is the six-month mark. We call this a season or a semester, half a year. At 6 months, we set the business metrics. We do what we call set the needles. These are the needles that we want to move for the business, the measures that are important, and we instrument these. That is, we're going to put telemetry in the software that is going to measure how we are succeeding at these things. We do these at the level of epics, to use the agile term. We have, for example, 8 epics across Visual Studio Team Services, including one for engineering improvements. And we will measure how we will have goals for the epics. So, for example, apropos this conference, one of the epics is around increasing open source and Java usage with team services. That's an example of an epic. And there'll be many things we do for that, including, ranging from supporting the IntelliJ IDE to doing better releases on Linux to our integration with Chef and so forth. So that's at 6 months, and then every sprint, each team will report on how it's doing against those. In between, about every 3 sprints, the leads of the feature crews will get together and say, well, what are we planning for the next three sprints? What do we expect to do? And they'll discuss, and you'll have conversations such as, it sounds like you're doing something that's similar to what we're doing. Maybe we should combine, and only one of us should do that. Or we expected something like this. Aren't you doing that? Or did we misunderstand? Or do we need to make another adjustment or something like that? Just a coordination meeting like that among the leads. Now, everyone knows a little bit about an 18-month vision. We know we will still be mobile first, cloud first in 18 months, but it's very thin. You know, it's like it's not that much different from, you know, what you know from the conference keynote. Within the sprint, we're working for 3 weeks on the items we've pulled as a team from the backlog. And at the third week, we start deployment of new functionality. And we do this first in one data center where we are working, which we call the canary. The canary is an expression. It comes from the English phrase, the canary in the coal mine. So miners used to carry a canary, and if the canary would fall over in the cage, it would mean there's no oxygen in the mine. So we make sure that this is very well instrumented, and we make sure where we're working is going well, and we observe the new software in our canary data center, scale unit zero, or SU0 we call it, and then as we're working, and then we use exposure control to continue to deploy two successive stages of data centers. We now deploy across 10 data centers worldwide. We recently went general availability in India. Brazil is in preview and is about to go up. And at the end of three weeks, development is done. Deployment continues, but development is done. You move to the next sprint. And done means code is done, tests is done, all of the telemetry and instrumentation for measuring the success in production is there and is working. Now, if you do Scrum, you probably know about sprint planning and sprint reviews and sprint retrospectives. We try to keep this very lightweight. So instead of having lots of meetings, we have a few very simple emails. I'll show you an example. This is an email from one team. You may not be able to read it. It's called Agile X. It's the name of the feature crew. The picture up here and the name of the guy who wrote it, Sandeep Chadha, is the guy who writes this. Sandeep is in Hyderabad. I'm in Seattle, so I'm glad that I get to see his sprint review by mail, so I don't have to. We're 12 hours apart, and I don't have to be up at midnight to attend the sprint review. Now, he says, we've done these things. He has a sprint video, which I'll show you in a minute. He has a list of each item that they did, each feature or user story, in this case, live updates on the Kanban board, auto update, and a picture of it, a little description, a picture of it. And sorry, there are links here to the our own team services so I can see the item in team services for detail, and a link to user voice where our end users have asked for this. So there are two sets of links in this example. Same thing for the next one, board filtering, same thing for the next one. And these are the things they've accomplished. And then the second part of the email is the Sprint 98 plan. So what are we planning for the next sprint? Again, with hyperlinks to everything in our team services. And I can see who all is on the team who's contributing. So this is effectively a group mail from this feature crew of 12. Now, what does it look like? Well, let's start with a sprint video. Let me see if I can play that as a video bigger. So the sprint video will
typically get update with any of the changes. So let me show you what I'm talking about. So on this board, let me create new feature.
Do you hear this language? Let me show you what I'm talking about. The idea is not we did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The idea is before it was like this, now it's better. Let me show you. Let me show you how. It's a demo. Okay, and it's a demo that anyone can watch asynchronously, anytime, so that we don't all have to get together in a meeting room. But I'm showing it to you now, and you can watch it, and you can
feature in case
listen to Sandeep do his demo.
The same card at the same time. So here I'm accessing this board on its way to the layout. As soon as the user clicks,
and you don't need to listen to him go through this, but basically he shows you that he has two boards, and he makes a change on one board, and the other one updates. So if you're in two locations, updating a card here updates the card there. And this works great for distribution, and it's done by virtue of having this little wireless icon, the glyph, visible on the board. That's the idea of the video. So it's a great way to distribute the demo day or the sprint review. And the idea is these should be, 2 to 5 minutes, because there are a lot of them, and you should be it should be a succinct little demo of this work. Now, of course, this team, like every other team, has its own Kanban board of its work, and this card is one of the cards in the completed column that they did. When I look at their section of our team services, and if I double click on that card, I see what you see right here with auto refresh on the Kanban board. It has all the links for the spec. It has the link to user voice where customers wrote what they wanted. It has a section here for release notes. This will be automatically pulled into the release notes that are published when this goes live. I can see down here the adoption tiers, that is the status of deployment as deployment is going on in terms of where this is available at any particular time. So that is the way a team works and then reports across the enterprise for alignment. And they report using the common team services. They report correlating to user voice where users have said, here are enhancements we would like, and they will report in their summary against metrics we've agreed are important for the business. Let's go to the second learning, managing technical debt. The problem with technical debt when you're running a service is that if you don't carefully pay down technical debt and keep it low or zero, it will throw up lots of surprises. and you will have lots of problems with the service that are unexpected work. In our case, we have an unusual situation that makes this more extreme. We not only deliver the service, which we deliver every 3 weeks with significant updates, that is Visual Studio Team Services here at the bottom, but we continue to deliver the on-premise Team Foundation server, where we take these three-week updates and approximately every 3 months deliver an update for on-premise customers for them to install. So on-premise customers take the update. So for example, right now, Team Foundation server is in version 2015 update 2, and customers install that. Users of Team Services, the hosted one from Azure, just automatically get the current version. And we have a web page where everyone can see this Team Services features timeline. Let me make this slightly smaller, where you see, for example, here is what we just released to the server on this date, to the services on this date. Here is when it goes over here into the server on-premise, 2015 update 2. And for any of these, I can click and see the particular release notes and go through and understand what that was or what is intended to be. And we tell you about what's coming as well. So we try to keep all of that transparent. And of course, the issue is that in order to keep that transparent and to keep that somewhat predictable, we can't have surprises from technical debt. So we have to work a little bit differently. In the past, we used to manage source in a way where we would have branches. And if I wanted to work on something new, I would say, OK, I will create a branch, and I will go off for 3 months and work in this branch. And then I will come back, and I will merge my branch. And then for 2 weeks, nothing would work. The change that we have is we do not have long-lived branches anymore. We use Git as distributed version control, and everything is in one master branch, not many, one. And the branches are very short-lived. They're tiny. So they only have very small deviations. So it's one topic, one work item, maybe one bug. And you have tiny continuous merging of those changes back to master. So it's not a large batch where you don't know how the code fits. It's one little thing, you know, 10 lines, 20 lines. And the code is fresh in your mind when you merge. So we keep one master. The master is fresh. We're working on that. We don't have all this merge debt. The second big change that we have done is to test differently. In the past, when we were shipping just the on-premise product, we tested when everything came together. These are what we call L3 tests. They're integration tests. Everything worked together in a big scenario, or we would prove that it would work together in a big scenario. Now, we test in the sprint. The feature crew delivers tests with code, and the tests go at the lowest level against the code to the interface contract that needs to be delivered by the particular service. So it forces the product to be designed for testability, and it forces the test code to be written to the quality of product code so that tests can be run anywhere and run reliably. And other crews can use tests to validate that they are correctly consuming features. This has been a big change. We've shifted left in testing to test earlier, and we've shifted right to put in more instrumentation and telemetry so we can observe what's happening in production, so we can see if anything has escaped and catch it when it's running. That's about technical debt. Let's talk about customer value. We've known to look at customer value for a long time. Now with services, we can measure it. One of the principles we have for measuring it, we call embrace the red. Embrace the red means don't focus on the 99.9% of end users who have good experiences. Look at the 0.001 who are unhappy and understand why. So here's a great example. One of our service reliability engineers was looking at a VM and saw, this particular user or group of users is getting slower and slower performance. And the reason appears to be a noisy neighbor, another service on the same virtual machine. And the neighbor doesn't belong to us. And he took corrective action for that particular instance, but he noted that there are two actions we needed to take. First, we needed to have telemetry to detect a noisy neighbor and to automatically move our process off onto a fresh virtual machine. And second, we needed to notify the other service, the neighbor service, so that they could put in telemetry so that they would be well behaved about resource consumption. That's an example of an embrace the red philosophy. That's quantitative. Qualitatively, we also reach out to customers. This is user voice that you see on this part of the screen. And the top one says, implement real-time collaboration on the Kanban board. That is, in fact, the user voice line that you saw the video for with 309 votes. That means 309 users said, yes, we want that. And when we closed it with the feature that you saw, they got those votes back. Every user gets 5 votes. And so they get to now vote on something else. We also take our engineers, like you see in this table, and we ask everyone to reach out and buddy up with a customer and have roughly every month a conversation where you can say, hey, you know, how is your experience using team services? What do you like? What do you wish for? What should we do differently? Are there things, you know, that you've experienced that you would like? Do you have suggestions? And you just become friends, and you learn a lot by talking to people. So these are things you can't get from the quantitative telemetry by observing usage. These are things you get by talking to people about what they do. That's customer value. The three things I just talked to you about you can think of as second decade agile. Good agile or agile on steroids. Now let's talk about things that are new with DevOps, the backlog groomed with learning. This is sometimes called build, measure, learn. Lean Startup by Eric Ries calls it this. Sometimes it's called hypothesis-driven development. The principle is that unlike the days when we just did Agile or we did Waterfall and we had very smart product owners or very smart business analysts who could tell us what the customer wanted. We realize we don't know. So we have hypotheses. And our learning is that about a third of the time, the hypotheses are right. About a third of the time, they're wrong. And about a third of the time, they don't make any difference. So what we do is we state the backlog in hypotheses. From the hypotheses, we make experiments. And from the experiments, which are instrumented with telemetry, we collect validated learning. And from that learning, we decide what to do next. Here's a simple example. We used to have an experience where a new user would go up to team services and would encounter this when creating, would be asked to create a team project. 36% of users would go ahead and create a team project, which you really need before you do anything else. That means 64% did not get further. We ran a series of experiments. And after three experiments, we increased this to by about 18%. We would run each experiment by directing a portion of traffic to the new version and seeing how they did. Sometimes they did better, sometimes they did worse. But we could come up with a much simpler version that improved the success of the front door. Simple example, we do this all the time to improve attraction. One of the ways we do this is with feature flags. The idea of a feature flag is that when you start a new feature, you register a flag. The flag is there so that all the code in master can always be deployed, but particular features can be hidden. They may not be exposed at runtime. And that can be controlled not just for everyone, but can be controlled for individual users or groups of users. So you can raise the flag at the level of users or groups at any time in production at runtime. And you can add users or groups. So when you hear an expression like private preview, that means the users who are inside and have the flag raised are the ones who said, hey, I want to be in that circle of early adopters, and their flags are raised. This enables the idea of a dark launch, the idea that you can start pushing things out into production without making any announcement and just have a few users try them. It allows you to do continual experimentation where you have a group that keeps trying things in preview and you refine them while you go. That's hypothesis-driven development or grooming the backlog with learning. We can do that because we're continually gathering evidence in production through telemetry. What we use is something that is internally called Kusto. Externally, this is the basis of what you can sign up for on Azure as Application Insights. To give you an idea of the scale of what we collect, I pulled these numbers this morning, and across about 120 services, we are now ingesting over 700 terabytes of data daily from these services. So this data is being collected just from production by usage. And this includes the quantitative data and the logs, and is being used for any kind of troubleshooting, and it's being used for insights about usage and for both, you know, regular sorts of dashboards and ad hoc queries. Now that enables a production-first mindset, or as Satya Nadella, our CEO, calls it, a live site culture. In a live site culture, the most important thing is the status of the site. That is, you want it to be up, you want it to be available to users, you want the status to be visible. So we always make it visible, both on our blog and on Twitter. Why Twitter? Twitter, because it's shared nothing. If everything at Microsoft is unavailable, Twitter is probably still up. It's a completely independent channel. So we push the information about status both places, and we sort of have an automatic tool that will very quickly push status information out in real time. Now, we get the site back up, we mitigate as quickly as possible when there's a live site incident, and that is done by the same engineers who develop it. You build it, you run it. We also, at the end of every week, review all live site incidents and do a root cause analysis. We use the five whys practice of Toyota and try to get to what is the root cause and what are the things we need to do in order to prevent this from happening again. And we will then tell customers about it and put this on a blog so that it's fully transparent. So if you look on the blog, it's Brian Harry's blog, it's my boss, you will see analyses like this that we publish. This one on the right, for example, goes down to the level of the SQL query plans and the memory consumption by SQL query plans and does an analysis of the differences between SQL 2016 and SQL 2014 in memory consumption on query plan optimization that is the level of depth that we share. And we talk about what we do in terms of technical and process improvements not to be affected by these things again. Now, when you are doing this live site culture and you're expecting your engineers who are building the services also to be running them, you need to demonstrate not only that you're doing good things for your end users, but also for your colleagues and employees. You're making their lives better. One example that comes out of that LSI, live site incident analysis for us, is alerting. We thought when we started that you needed to have alerts everywhere, that you needed great awareness from very many alerts. What we discovered the effect of that was that we had very many alerts. And that meant that we needed a human being to go through screens and screens of alerts and say, that's the important one, and therefore I need to call that person in order to have him or her be the one to investigate this issue. And this process of going through all those alerts led to a high time to escalation, and it was very frustrating. Everyone thought it was waste. So we said, instead of having human beings triage these alerts, let's automate that. We created what we call a health model, where we took the structure of the code and the structure of the organization, and we said, we'll use that knowledge to automate finding the right engineer and create what we called an auto dialer. And when we did and put that in place, We had an 80x reduction in the number of alerts and a doubling in the accuracy of finding the right individual for on-call. So it was an example of doing something in engineering improvements for us to make us more efficient and our lives better. A learning we would not have thought of without the experience. Another piece of LiveSite culture is security. Security, we've known about for 15 years. We've had a security development life cycle. We have taught security, practiced security. We've had a big culture around it, but it's changed. It's changed in the last 5 years. We used to think the big important thing was to protect the perimeter, to have a very good wall around the castle and to make it high and thick and prevent attackers from getting in. What's become clear is that that's not enough. The attackers get in anyway. The attackers are what we call advanced persistent threats. They are ninjas. They use social engineering to steal credentials. They are very sophisticated at reconnaissance. And if you study all of the major things that have made headlines, Sony, Target, US government personnel, and so forth, these are all examples where the attackers were inside the network. So our new motto is assume breach. Never say you are not under attack. Assume someone is inside. So we conduct war games where we have red teams and blue teams. Red teams are ethical hackers who work for us, who study everything that they can about successful attacks and run those against us. So they try to steal credentials. They try to exfiltrate data. They try to move laterally. They try to establish command and control inside and so forth. The blue team, who are our regular defenders, they try to detect right away. They try to push the attackers out. They try to limit the scope of damage. They try to protect data and so forth. And because they do this all the time in the simulated scenarios, and they don't necessarily know what's going on because they don't communicate with the red team, they get practiced at it. So they know how to do this in real life. This has been very effective for us, and it's improved our tooling quite a bit for detecting when there might be real attacks. The seventh learning is how you manage infrastructure as a flexible resource. We, of course, can do this because we have the public cloud with Azure, which we are a customer of, like you would be customers of it. We use our own release management, which is part of Team Services for automation. This is the automation that you see inside Team Services, deploying Team Services. We, as I mentioned, have multiple data centers with multiple scale units for deploying. San Antonio is our canary, scale unit zero. Chicago is the next one in the deployment sequence, scale unit one. Australia is seven after Australia is, I think now India is eight, and Brazil nine, and so forth. There are over 50,000 active users inside Microsoft of Team Services. So every deployment goes to them. They are our most demanding users. They claim special rights. So we pay attention to them, it gives you a feeling of the scale we need to support. We have several companies now, over 1,000, who are external companies who are enterprise level users as well, like Shell, the energy company, Deloitte, LexisNexis, and so forth. Those are the seven learnings. The team autonomy and enterprise alignment, managing technical debt, focusing on the flow of customer value, grooming the backlog with learning, gathering evidence in production, applying a production-first mindset, and managing infrastructure as a flexible resource. The metrics we track for that are around live site health, that is, what is the availability, performance, and so forth of the production environment for end users. Velocity, that is, how quickly do we get from product backlog or code commit to deployment. Engineering governors, these are around keeping technical debt down. Things like bug cap, are there live bugs, are there old bugs? What's the test pass rate and coverage? And usage, that is everything around the business funnel. Are we acquiring customers? Are we engaging them? Are we retaining them? Are they becoming more active? Or are they dropping off with churn? So let me give you a quick demo of how we've productized that with release management in team services. Now, if you were here in the panel session, I said one of the first things you ought to do, if you're not doing it, is continuous integration, continuous delivery. Let me give you an example. So I have here a little website. It's called People Tracker. It just is a little contact site. If you'd like to play along, you can enter your own name here at peopletracker.us. You can go People Tracker and then on the home page, you'll see it has different deployment environments. Click on the dev environment and click on people on the top. Hello, up here. I'm sorry, I'm working through a remote desktop. And enter your name. So I'll enter mine as an example. Very simple. Now in, you see this says first name, last name. That's all it does. It's a little demonstration. If I look at my team services backlog, one of the things on the backlog from our product owner is this idea that we should add a middle name to People Tracker, and I see this here, and it's item 221, and it's in the expedite lane, and I'll move it to development. And I will flip to Visual Studio, which I have here. Now you probably can't see this, so let's make it bigger. If you see in Visual Studio up here under changes, I've already made the changes in the code to add the middle name and I'll add a comment here for it. And it's for item 221. Let's make that a little bigger so you can see it. And there's a little, if you haven't used Visual Studio recently with Git, there's a little button here for submitting your commits. And let me get my mouse back. Sorry, the terminal is a little jumpy. Come on. I'm doing this off of a remote instance. And I will I think I just sync this. Did I just sync this? Oh, I just put in a crazy comment from my laptop. So you know it's live. Come on. I'll commit all and push. All right. So, and yes, I do want to do that. So now if I flip back to look at Team Services and go to the build, we're looking at the Kanban board, we'll look at the build. What I would expect to see is because I had that set up as a continuous integration build, as a CI build, if I look at queued, I would see a new build starting, and indeed I do see a new build starting, number 709, and it says queued just now. And if I click on it, I'll see that it's in fact running. Looks like I made a typo, which from moving around, which I won't try to fix because it'll end up running over time. So I'll show you the what a release looks like. What that would do is trigger a release automatically. Both the builds and the releases are defined in a similar manner as a set of tasks. And the tasks are, in the case of a release, defined by an environment. So here, the releases are pulling from, the build is set up to push the changes into a Docker container, which goes up to Docker Hub. And then the release pulls the changes back down from Docker Hub and then deploys them across subsequent environments and deploys database changes with them on Docker Hub. And I can see for each stage in the deployment of each release, I can see exactly what has happened at each stage through automation, what's run, take one of these environments and get to the corresponding log for each stage of the environment. So I have automation at the build and at the release environment for each step along the way. So Team Services makes that really easy for me to take it from a push or a commit inside Visual Studio. It picks up the build, runs the build automation, runs the tests, in this case Selenium, or whatever unit test framework you would like, or load test you would like in QA, and then stands that up in the next environment where you can have more extensive testing or more extensive static analysis or make things available for manual testing, exploratory testing, user acceptance testing, and then pushes it to the next environment and so on. In this case, these are all Linux. This is using Docker containers to pull it down, running it on Azure, so you have the you have development on Windows, deployment on Linux as well. So that is all, that is an example of the automation. That's the automation we use to deploy our own service. This is the diagram of what you just saw. So it goes to Docker Hub, it goes, deploys the database, and then it does three times across Linux. And that's the philosophy, because we think that what really counts is that there's no place like production. That's what I have to share with you. I will be, after this session, on the other side at the Ask the Speakers area, which is on the other side of the exhibits, and can will be happy to talk to you there. So I can take maybe one question or two questions here, but continue there. Thank you very much. どうもありがとうございます。